From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, teaching English to the children of Asian and Hispanic immigrants in a high school on New York's Lower East Side, we meet teacher Jessica Siegel and journalist Samuel Friedman, the author of a book about her. Also, we talk with writer Craig Lucas and director Norman Renee. Their new film, Longtime Companion, is one of the first movies about the effect of AIDS on the gay community. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel, The Innocent, by British writer Ian McEwan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Supreme Court stepped into another abortion case today and agreed to review next term a case testing whether the government may bar publicly funded family planning clinics from informing patients about the abortion option. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The federal government spends $200 million a year to help fund family planning clinics that serve poor women all over the country. Federal law bars any public money from being used to pay for actual abortions. And in 1988, the Reagan administration went further, issuing regulations that barred any clinic that received federal money from telling patients about the abortion option or referring patients to abortion clinics. The regulations required that if a patient were to ask about the abortion option, doctors were to advise the patient that abortion is not considered an appropriate method of family planning. New York State and city officials and the directors of family planning clinics challenged the regulations, claiming that they violated both free speech rights and abortion rights. But a federal appeals court in New York upheld the regulations. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to examine the issue. A decision is not expected until next year. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Canada's House of Commons narrowly approved today a bill requiring women to get a doctor's consent for an abortion. The bill, which still requires Senate approval, is intended to replace an abortion law that was struck down by Canada's Supreme Court in 1988. The measure is backed by Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, but neither abortion rights nor anti-abortion activists appear to like it. Anti-abortion forces say it virtually permits abortion on demand. Abortion rights activists say no law is needed. South African President F.W. de Klerk has postponed next month's scheduled visit to the U.S. John Matham reports from Johannesburg that it's unlikely the visit will take place this year.
The president cited the controversy over the timing of the trip and work commitments at home as his reason for deciding not to proceed. Foreign Minister Pik Botha stressed there had been no pressure from the African National Congress in South Africa, who were not unhappy that President Bush was to meet Mr. de Klerk before ANC Deputy President Nelson Mandela. The main reason for deciding to stay at home is the wish to avoid what a government source described as petty politicking. Organizers of Mr. Mandela's trip to the U.S., Randall Robinson and Jesse Jackson, are reported to have been organizing demonstrations and boycotts in protest at Mr. de Klerk's visit. Mr. de Klerk and his advisers judged it imprudent to enter the volatile world of U.S. protest politics at a time when he is enjoying a positive image after his European trip. For National Public Radio, I'm John Matham in Johannesburg.
Stock prices shot up today on Wall Street. A surge in the final minutes of trading recovered Friday's big losses and took prices to a record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 49 points to close at 2,870.49. This is NPR News. The Justice Department has asked Special Prosecutor Arlen Adams to expand his probe of former Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. Attorney General Dick Thornburg has asked Adams to review allegations that political favoritism was involved in the awarding of grants through two more programs operated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The allegations came from one of Pierce's former top aides, Du Bois Gilliam, now serving a prison sentence for corruption. The queen of American jazz singers, Ella Fitzgerald, is given France's highest arts award today, Commander of Arts and Letters. Lynn Terry prepared this report.
I love Paris in the springtime.
Today, Ella Fitzgerald had another reason to love Paris. During a brief ceremony, French culture minister Jacques Lang said she was the most famous American in France. He said her voice was eternal, and that when she sings, she gives others a joie de vivre. Fitzgerald was visibly moved when he tied the medal around her neck. She said it was a great honor, and that after so many years, it made her feel as if she was still loved.
I'm thrilled. I'm very thrilled that they chose me. So that makes me so happy that sometimes it's kind of hard to just say what you want to say.
Ella Fitzgerald is the fifth American jazz musician to receive the Commander of Arts and Letters, but the first woman. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
NASA has postponed the launch of the Space Shuttle Columbia, scheduled for today, because sensors detected a hydrogen leak during the fueling of the Space Shuttle's external fuel tank. NASA will announce a new launch date once the leak has been found and a repair is planned. The Space Shuttle was to have blasted off on its mission just after midnight tonight. It's to carry a $148 million cargo of space telescopes called the Astro Observatory. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jessica Siegel spent 9 years teaching high school English to some of America's newest immigrants. She taught at Seward High School in Manhattan's Lower East Side. When the school was built in 1930, the students were primarily from the families of Jewish and Italian immigrants. Now the school's population is 45% Hispanic, 45% Asian, and 7% African American. About 40% of the students drop out, yet the majority of students who graduate go on to college, trade school, or the military. A year in the life of teacher Jessica Siegel is the subject of a new book by journalist Samuel Friedman. He left his job at the New York Times to write this book. The school year that he observed Siegel, 1987 to 88, turned out to be her last as a teacher. She left teaching and running the school newspaper to become a freelance journalist and to direct a program designed to enrich the quality of high school journalism. Jessica Siegel and Samuel Friedman are my guests today. I asked Siegel if there's much violence in the neighborhood around Seward High and in the school itself.
Well, the Lower East Side is known by some as the drug marketplace of New York City. That was the place where the first Operation Pressure Point to try to get rid of crack started. And they tried the same operation in other boroughs. So crack is, and the violence that it brings with it is always there. Gangs are very active. The violence is there. It sometimes comes into the school, though rarely. I think, if anything, the school is kind of a haven for people. But it's always there, and the times that there is a fight, for example, and it didn't happen that often, it usually came from an incident that happened outside the school.
Well, you make the point in the book that a lot of the most violent high school-age kids don't bother going to school, and that's one of the things that saves a school from being very violent.
Yeah, but I think it's important really to think about is that yes, that's absolutely true, and I think Sam talks about, you know, these BMWs that drive around the school sort of flaunting the riches you can get if you get into the drug trade. But I think that another thing that comes out in the book is that so many kids are on the edge. I mean, when you think about the moral decisions that kids have to make every day when they walk by these people who are selling crack for which they can make $1,000 a week, in a sense, every day is a moral decision, and many people are on the edge.
Yeah, actually, these kids come out in some ways incredibly morally armored. Now, watching some of Jessica's students get into college, it's been interesting to see them rather shocked by the amount of beer drinking, for instance, that some of their classmates from suburban towns partake in. Because if you grow up outside the city, as I did, for instance, there's a forbidden fruit quality to drug use, to overdoing it with alcohol, all those things, because you don't really have a sense of how treacherous they are. The kids on the Lower East Side have had instruction from their youth in exactly what the consequence is. And I think that the kids who get involved don't do it because of any allure on the part of getting high. They do it because of the economic gravity sucking them in. And the kids who don't partake or who dabble and then are able to extricate themselves. And I mean, I remember a kid at Seward who had started using heroin at 13 and just was sensible enough to stop on his own. Those kids are so well defended in terms of their common sense by the time they're 17 or 18 that I really feel that in many ways they're almost impregnable, at least to that kind of problem later in life.
I think that one of the things you really have to do when you're teaching is to let the kids know that the classroom is a safe haven. And you have to be able to back that up. you know, so that they really do have confidence that the classroom is safe. Jessica, how would you establish that with the students? And how did you do it when you were inexperienced? And how did that change when you became a veteran?
A couple of things. I think I'm not sure how you're using the word safe. I'm interpreting it to mean safe that you can say anything, safe that you can try out ideas, safe you can...
And that you're physically safe, that no one's going to beat you up while you're in class. No one's going to pull a knife on you while you're in class.
Well, believe it or not, I mean...
I taught very briefly, and that was, I thought, a real big issue when I was teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never felt that way. I mean, all I can say is I'm 5'3" and I walk down the halls and I never felt physically threatened. So, I don't know what to say. I think as a new teacher, and Sam describes this very well, I mean, you know, the thing about getting your sea legs, about learning how to teach is a big issue. I mean, yes, when I started teaching, I couldn't control a class. Yes, there were paper airplanes thrown and crumpled up pieces of paper. Yes, people were screaming, you know, and saying, he pulled my hair, that kind of stuff, despite the fact that it was in high school. All those things happen. And, you know, that's no place that anybody wants to be in a class, because most of the people, whether they're not, they're the most studious people or, in fact, have to be wooed into doing the assignment. Nobody wants to be trying to work in chaos where they can't even hear themselves think. So that part of it was a process where of trial and error, of bombing a lot, of picking up pointers from colleagues, of trying things and failing again, and learning a little bit more, and learning from my students what kinds of things worked and what didn't.
Jessica, you had students who were, some of whom were homeless, some of whom were living in shelters, many of whom were from, like, poor families. How important is it to really understand the home life of each of your students? And when you have 140 students, what can you do to get a sense of what their lives are like outside of school and how that's going to affect the kind of students that they are and how you can help them in their learning?
Well, I always thought it was important in my English classes to have my students write autobiographies, because I really feel that in the 40 minutes a day that you have kids sit in front of you, there's always more to know. I mean, if a kid falls asleep in class or doesn't do the homework for 2 weeks or is absent for a week, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's bored or you're boring. I mean, it didn't take me long working at Seward to figure out there's a whole lot of other things that affect how a student does. What I found, well, first of all, let me just add that I would say in the 10 years I taught, if 4 kids ever tried to get over by saying, feel sorry for me, I'm poor, it was a lot. Most kids are extraordinarily stoic, brave, and they assume that they have to deal with these things on their own. And the autobiographies for me was a chance to get to know them better and a chance for them to tell me a little bit more about themselves. Some of the things I encountered in these autobiographies included a kid who wrote, and he is an incredible writer, about this incident that happened when he was 14. He was involved in gangs, and he was walking down the street with his best friend who wasn't involved in a gang, and they were attacked by another gang, and the friend was killed. And this kid ended up in the hospital. And when he woke up from his coma, he realized what had happened. He was so devastated by his friend being killed that he went to apologize to his friend's mother and visits the grave every year and really kind of turned his life around because of that. Another kid I discovered was a father, but unlike so many teenage males, took responsibility, married the young woman. They're together, they were both going to school, raising their daughter, and both working, and clearly showed a responsibility and maturity way beyond his years. Another young woman was living in such an abusive household that she chose to move out of her house and to live in a group home, which is, as you can imagine, not the greatest place to live, because she just couldn't take it anymore. Now, these are just, I mean, just 3 examples of the incredible things that these kids have to deal with, you know, parents who are institutionalized in mental institutions. It was really important for me to know about it and for them to tell me about it.
Now, you're the kind of teacher who really
is behind the students. You want them to be able to succeed, to go to college, to get a scholarship. And at the same time, you have to grade them, and you know if they haven't been doing well in class. Even if they would like to go to college, you have to give them that low grade, and that low grade is going to keep them out of college. Was grading a terrible ethical crisis for you? Because you really wanted the kids to succeed, but there were times when you couldn't give them a good grade. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yes, it was. And I think, those nights where I was deciding on grades, it was like I felt I was... Solomon or something. I really went through a lot of trials coming up with the grades. But, obviously along the way I was saying, well, what happened to that revision of your autobiography? What happened to that revision of your that essay you had to do? And I was constantly harassing them. But the end, I had to give a grade, and I had to make it, and I had to, decide on based on the work they handed in.
So you felt you had to maintain certain standards no matter how much you really liked and admired a student.
Yeah, and a couple of times kids who failed my class came back the second time and really came through the second time because they realized what they had to do to pass the class. They realized that, you couldn't get over the ones that were getting over and respected me for holding on to those standards.
So you think really the best kind of teacher for kids who... are up against certain obstacles like poverty, like not having English as a first language, that the best thing to do is to really be a strong, assertive, tough teacher who has standards to maintain and isn't going to let people get away with things.
It's got to be a combination of both the traits Jessica manifested. It's got to be, on one hand, caring.
Right,
and
exactly.
On the other hand,
I guess
standards,
I neglected to mention that.
Because you can't have one without the other. And that's
the problem
with people who think you can just come in and be prescriptive and say, read this, it's a great book. Do it because you need to get the mark to get into college. You need what Jessica had was the world of the 40 minutes in the class, which was read this because it's important and some good lessons on why something like Gatsby or Thoreau was important to a kid in 1987. But at the same time, there was the whole part she and a lot of other teachers play outside those 40 minutes, which is being guidance counselor, being social worker, being surrogate mother. And it's all that other work that makes a good 40 minutes in class possible.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guests are Sam Friedman and Jessica Siegel. Friedman is a former New York Times reporter who spent a year observing Siegel and her colleagues teach at a Manhattan high school. And Friedman's book is called Small Victories, and it's an account of that year. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jessica, what were some of the things in the system, in the educational system, that you felt stood in your way or, interfered with you doing your best?
Well, the one point that I feel extraordinarily strongly about is the idea of class size, which always comes down to money. But as far as I'm concerned, it's not a debatable point, especially since Bush is talking about being an education president, because I had... five classes a day of 34 students. Multiply that together, that's 170 kids a day. Now, I have to pat myself on the back to say that I was extraordinarily hardworking. I felt that writing was the chasm that separated kids from being able to move up in the world. In other words, a majority of my students, for example, to go to a job interview would know how to dress perfectly. And despite something that may surprise people, they also knew how not to talk in street language and to talk in formal English. But once they would be asked to write something, that's the chasm. So therefore, obviously, I put a lot of emphasis on writing and revision. And if you do that, and you have 170 students a day, that means you're constantly marking papers. I mean, every test I gave had two essays. Now, I had kids who complained to high heaven because nobody else had ever given them this. All their teachers gave multiple choice questions. But, you know, how are they going to be prepared for college if they never have to write an essay, if they never have to express themselves in writing rather than just checking off true and false or A, B, C, or D? So doing that means that every time I gave a test, it was 8 hours of correcting. So my feeling is, you know, for teachers who, you know, are trying to do something, the only way to improve education for both them and for, to give the kids more personal attention is to reduce class sizes. And possibly for new teachers, ones who are just getting their feet on the ground, give them a reduced load so that they can learn to teach, be mentored by more experienced teachers, and really observe a lot of teachers so they can pick up pointers. Otherwise, I mean, things are never going to get better.
Did you have the books you needed, the supplies that you needed?
Well, I was lucky because I had a great chairman in the English department, which means that to a certain extent I could order books that I wanted, to a certain extent. The big issue for me was the Xerox machine, because I know some of your listeners will be surprised to hear that in the New York City schools, and perhaps it's changing now, I don't know if new technology has quite hit, but what I was using were Dittos, Rexos. I'm sure people have to hunt back to, in their mind, to antediluvian times to remember what that was. It's these purple things that get all over you. And so every night I was typing these Rexos and then running them off. Now, when you think about how corporations and the government just churn out Xeroxes, Xerox copies of things. I mean, law firms like throw out truckloads of you know, Xerox legal papers. To think that if I wanted to do a short story from one book, I couldn't, you know, that I got out from the library or from home, I couldn't do it. I had to type it up. I mean, it's outrageous because, you know, otherwise you're limited to what's in the book room.
Sam Friedman wrote in his book about you that there were nights that you'd go home and cry.
Mm-hmm.
What would you be crying about on those nights?
Exhaustion, probably. I mean, you know, probably exhaustion about all the work that had faced me by the time I got home and how much longer I had to work that night before I could then go to bed and get up in the morning.
To work some more.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you just have to ask yourself if it's possible to be a good teacher and to stay at it for very long when you're dealing with, what did you say, 170 students a day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just such an enormous... I don't know how people could keep that many names straight, let alone really understand each of the students.
Well, believe it or not, the names part is not that...
It's easy. Okay.
It's not that difficult. I mean, and I want to underline the fact is that there's some wonderful teachers who are still teaching, you know, at Seward and in other places and are keeping at it.
So the other thing that happens is that the kids become the gasoline that the teachers' engines run on.
Mm-hmm.
And that... There was not only nights when Jessica would cry, there were sometimes in her free periods when she'd sneak off to the school auditorium and just sob. And, you know, being the journalistic sniper that I am, I'd sit a couple of rows behind making notes on what the tears sound, what the sob sounded like. But then she'd go back into class, and it was incredible to see the kids transform her, that they would nourish her, and that would let her stay 10 years teaching 170 kids a day in those conditions. Was her ability to feed off those young people. And what keeps, I think, a lot of her friends in school is the same thing. And I guess the other point about her leaving is that we have perhaps this exaggerated idea of the importance of longevity, and that it's great if someone can stay and teach 40 years and be committed at it. But there are a lot of people at Seward who had been there 30 years corporeally and had been there emotionally about 5 years. And what Jessica did in 10 years was have a whole lifetime career of success.
Jessica, you should explain why you did leave, because we haven't really gotten to that yet.
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, I think any decision is a combination of personal and external factors. I mean, I think the workload that I was feeling, that I had no free time for myself. All I did was work. I think another aspect was I taught journalism, and in a sense, I felt kind of like it could have reactivated my feelings about journalism, because I felt like, you know, a marathon or a long distance runner who had sort of given up and then started teaching young people and then sort of reactivated their own love for it, and that's, that's the same thing for me in journalism.
Jessica, you mentioned you'd love to see the large class sizes cut down. I'd like both of you, from the perspective of teacher and journalist, to comment on other changes you'd like to see in the public schools.
All right. My wish list would be, especially in cities, no school more than 1,500 students, no class more than 20 or 22 students, a guidance counselor to student ratio instead of the current 600 to 1, more like 200 or 150 to 1, which is hardly great anyway, but is at least human. I think that there should be expansion of a couple of existing programs for teachers. There's one in Rochester, New York, that identifies master teachers, pays them $70,000 a year, which is a wage you can raise a family on in Rochester, and says in return for that title and that high pay, you will mentor a younger teacher, you will officially become a kind of surrogate parent to a dozen students, and you will work the year round rather than 10 months. That ought to be in place in every school district in the country. There's a program in the state of Connecticut where college kids who will commit a certain number of years, I'm not sure exactly how many, to teaching in the state schools get a tuition tax break or a waiver of some sort. I think that should be in every single state in the union. New Jersey has brought in alternative certification. I think that's really important because you have to face the fact that perhaps you'll never get enough Jessica Siegels coming into teaching, even if you increase it. But there are a lot of Sam Friedmans out there who are people who are doing other things but like to teach and might come in to teach a course or two if you'd make it possible for them to get paid and not to have to go through this emasculating bureaucracy. For instance, you know, I've worked 10 years in newspapers, wrote a book. I'm qualified to teach graduate students in journalism at Columbia University. I just finished teaching a term up there. I'm not qualified to teach journalism for pay in the New York public school system because my undergraduate major happened to be history instead of English. You know, that kind of absurdity has got to be ended. So you need, in that case, to break down the hegemony that the union has on hiring in a lot of places, certainly in New York City. And those are just all common sense solutions. The tragedy, the thing that galls me to no end, is that educators and parents, and even tragically to some extent, teachers themselves are ready to embrace this trend or that trend, this buzz phrase or that buzz phrase, whether it's relevance in the 60s, back to basics in the 70s, or school-based management in the 80s heading into the 90s. And there's so little stock put in common sense, so little stock put in what any classroom teacher and any of their kids knows are the easy solutions. And they are easy if you, you know, put the resources there and to some extent shift existing resources out of these Xanadus of bureaucracy like the New York Board of Ed headquarters and down to the level of the schools. It's not hard. You know, Diane Ravitch, the educational historian, has been pounding the pulpit on exactly this point. It's just too bad the common sense, you know, counts for so little in our current education reform debate.
Jessica, what would you like to add to that list?
I cannot add a thing. I think that sounds great to me. I vote for Sam for president.
Teacher Jessica Siegel and journalist Samuel Friedman. Friedman's book, Small Victories, is about Siegel, her students and colleagues, and the urban high school where she taught. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, theater director Peter Sellers. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Director Norman Renee and writer Craig Lucas have a Tony-nominated play on Broadway, Prelude to a Kiss. And they have a new movie in theaters, Longtime Companion. The movie's about the impact of AIDS on a circle of gay friends. Coming up, Lucas and Renee on the obstacles they were up against making the movie. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel, The Innocent, by British writer Ian McEwan, about a naive young British technician caught up in the Cold War in 1955. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Soviet Union, maverick communist Boris Yeltsin has been elected president of the Russian Republic, which gives him a strong public platform for his criticism of Soviet leader Gorbachev. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Boris Yeltsin has built a political career on his image as a persecuted populist. Every time the Communist Party leadership scolded him or stripped him of an important post, his public support rose higher. Today, the public cheered its delight when the Russian legislature chose Yeltsin its leader, rejecting a rival who had Gorbachev's backing. Russian Deputy Alexander Lubimov says learning to live with Yeltsin could be a hard lesson for Gorbachev.
He prefers his old and trusted supporters, the party apparatus. But this is not the way to manage the situation now. So.
Yeltsin's first challenge to Gorbachev is likely to come on a new package of national economic reforms introduced last week. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On the eve of the summit meeting in Washington, France and Poland have called on the West not to ignore Moscow's resistance to NATO membership for a unified Germany. In separate statements, officials of those two countries said that Soviet concerns are both real and understandable. The French foreign minister said that he had sympathy with Gorbachev's opposition to seeing East Germany, once Moscow's strongest Warsaw Pact ally, joining NATO as part of a unified Germany. In the United States, state and county officials are on the scene of a natural gas well explosion in the east-central Mississippi town of Heidelberg. One person is dead and four others were severely injured. Kevin Farrell of Public Radio in Mississippi reports.
The explosion occurred shortly after 2 o'clock this afternoon while employees were working on a well owned by R&H Oil and Gas Incorporated of Tickfall, Louisiana. The injured were taken to a hospital in nearby Laurel, Mississippi, and are being transferred to nearby burn centers. Glenn Cochran of the Heidelberg Police Department says authorities are trying to contain the fire.
We have equipment being moved in to contain the fire. The area around the well has been evacuated. We have emergency management people on the scene to ensure that the evacuation has taken place and that no one is admitted into the area.
Although the fire is still burning, officials who are on the scene monitoring the situation say the blaze is under control. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Farrell reporting.
State officials in Alaska say that a freight train that went off the tracks near Fairbanks yesterday spilled more than 100,000 gallons of fuel, which is more than first thought. No one was injured in the accident. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 49 points to close at a record 2,870.49. There was moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Writer Craig Lucas and director Norman Renee are waiting to see if their Broadway play Prelude to a Kiss will win the two Tonys it's nominated for. The play just won an Obie for Best New American Play. Lucas and Renee are also waiting to see how their new movie will do in theaters. The film, Longtime Companion, follows a circle of gay friends through the 1980s. The story begins in 1981, on the day the New York Times published its first story about a cancer that was striking gay men. By the time the film ends, AIDS has killed several of the men and changed the lives of the survivors. Longtime Companion was developed for Public TV's American Playhouse. I asked Renee and Lucas if it was difficult to find funding for a film about AIDS. Norman Renee answered first.
Pretty much. I think that there were some companies, when you simply mentioned that you had a project about AIDS, they said, I'm sure it's great. I don't even want to hear about it. We're not interested.
Yeah, why not? What were the reasons you got for that?
Well, the classic reason is that historically, movies about gay people have not made money, and movie companies are in the business of making money. And I think that disease movies, likewise, have primarily been the domain of television. And they're very skeptical about anything that is not uplifting or...
formulaic.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that no one really wanted to take a financial risk on that. In terms of the homophobia in Hollywood, which is often talked about, I think it's very difficult to say anything about that because no one was overtly homophobic in their response to the script.
Mm-hmm. But we did get one response from one major distribution company that American Playhouse went to in search for funds for the picture. And this particular company said, thank you for sending the script to Longtime Companion. We are concentrating, and I as an individual, the man who runs the studio, is also very much involved in charitable organizations. And he said, I am concentrating all of my efforts into educating the American public to realizing that AIDS is not a gay disease. I am still waiting to see the movie this man makes about IV drug users with AIDS.
You got money, I think, from the National Endowment for the Arts because the NEA gives some money to American Playhouse.
Yes.
Did you have to worry about the no homoeroticism clause?
This movie was made and practically finished its post-production by the time the Helms Amendment came in.
So was it not a concern, or?
It really wasn't. I think we were probably, I remember we were editing the film mm-hmm. when this whole thing sort of blew up and
the Corcoran.
I mean, I don't know what happens. As Lindsay Law, the executive producer, said, the movie opens in Washington this weekend, and I guess all the congressmen will get to see it and make up their own minds.
I would be very, very interested to see. I'm hoping in a way it will continue to push more buttons. The NEA is obviously endangered, and the more public attention that can be thrown on this Helms Amendment, the better. Joseph Papp stood up the other night at the Obie Awards and said what I've been feeling all along, which is that the controversy over the Mapplethorpe exhibit and the Helms Amendment boils down to one thing and one thing only, and that's gay and lesbian bashing. It is homophobia. It's nothing else. And I hope the lid can be blown off and it will stimulate more debate.
The story in Longtime Companion starts with all the characters in the movie reading the New York Times and finding out about this form of cancer that seems to be afflicting gay men. Is that how you first found out about AIDS, through the New York Times? Or did you read about it first in the gay press?
I think I found about it first from Craig, who had read it in the New York Times.
The first article to appear, I think, may have been in a medical journal like The Lancet. But the wire services picked it up in July of 81, and there it was on page A20 of the Times. You know, it went through Manhattan seismically like a tremor.
What effect did it have on you when you read it?
Well, if somebody says to you, now listen, you know, everything you've been doing for the last 10 years of your life looks like it could kill you. You hope that that's not true, and it seemed so unbelievable that really there could be a viral agent that was passing through the gay community. So much of it was mysterious and hard to process mentally. I was panicked. I remember that day, and I called Norman as well as several other friends and said, look at this. This is really wild. And then I think I slowly put it out of my mind. I looked for ways to deny it and pretend that it hadn't appeared.
When did it first actually hit you personally? I mean, have a personal impact on your life?
I had a friend, not a close friend, get sick within the first year, probably late fall of 81 or maybe the beginning of 82. Well-known stage director. And he really went into a steep and quick decline. Then the summer of 82, one of my very first lovers died of AIDS.
What were some of the issues you both had to think through in the writing and in the direction? In terms of putting the story of AIDS impact on a circle of gay friends on screen. Did you think of this as, you know, something for the mainstream audience, or the things that you felt you wanted to either tone down or introduce?
Well, I think I understand your question. The primary thing, I think, for both Craig, myself, and for the actors, was that we wanted to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're more concerned with that than necessarily what audience it would reach.
Mm-hmm.
It forced us to focus on the things that we thought were important and to let go of the things that we didn't feel were important.
Such as?
Well, for me, the movie was about people who, by circumstance, had a particular sexual preference. And the main focus of the movie was on the relationships between these people, not their sexuality. And I didn't want to cloud the issue by showing a lot of sort of graphic sexual scenes that didn't really contribute to the tone of the movie. But it was very important to me to show the intimacy between the characters. And to develop relationships and how those relationships grew or fell apart or were strengthened because of what happened in the course of the movie. It also seemed important to me not to turn the movie into a melodrama. It seemed to me that the fact of AIDS, the fact of people dying, losing friends, losing lovers, carried an enormous amount of weight with it. And I wanted to be careful not to indulge or make pathetic the movie. I don't know, Craig, do you want to...
Well, there's just so many things we could have gone into. And a lot of ground has been covered, perhaps not as thoroughly as it needs to be, but the very, very infrequent feature film that has focused on gay characters has almost to a one been about fringe characters. And they have focused largely on backroom bar sex, baths, late night, leather bar kind of behavior. All of which, of course, goes on, and I've certainly seen my share of all of that, but it seemed that the only thing that Movies was willing to show was that element of gay life. And I know just as many straight people who've been to Hellfire and clubs like that, and I've been to those places myself and seen those things, and no movies ever seem to be made about heterosexual relationships from that angle. So I didn't see any need to contribute to the pervasive national notion that gay people stay up all night, have sex with hundreds of people, and wear dresses or leather or are hairdressers or in some way exotic, extravagant, overly anything, overly witty, overly sad, overly lonely. there are tens of millions of gay people in this country, and most of them get up in the morning and go to a regular job. Gay people are not all one thing any more than brown-haired people are all one thing. But I do know that a friend of mine who has AIDS went to the doctor the other day to see his doctor, and he's sitting there in the waiting room, and the other people in the waiting room were seven other middle-class gay men in their suits, their gray suits with their attaché cases. And that's a world that I had never seen on film, and it's the world that I see day in and day out. And it was very, very important to me to let the world at large know that being gay is not in and of itself extraordinary, that what has been extraordinary about these last 10 years are that gay people have banded together and created some kind of a community to protect and fight for themselves, and that they have nothing to be ashamed of. So, yes, we we talked about this a lot, and it was terribly, terribly important that we bring it home.
Playwright and screenwriter Craig Lucas and director Norman Renee are my guests. Their new film, Longtime Companion, is about the impact of AIDS on a circle of gay friends. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Lucas and Norman Renee are my guests. They're the writer and director of the new film Longtime Companion. They also collaborated on the Broadway show Prelude to a Kiss, which is nominated for a couple of Tonys. You've both been collaborating for, well, at least 10 years. And I think you've worked together on every project that you've done. How did you start working together?
A mutual friend gave me the first act of Craig's first play. I was then running a small theater company called The Production Company. Uh-huh. And I read the play and really liked it, and I called Craig and I said, if you'll finish this, I'll produce it. And he did, and I did.
I wonder if success threatens to break up the partnership in the sense that now between Prelude to a Kiss and Longtime Companion are both getting well-known, and it's conceivable one of you would be offered something without the other. Have you talked that through yet?
Well, that's happened. That circumstance has come up for us long before our current and, I'm sure, momentary notoriety. Many, many years ago, I had a play that I wanted to do at an off-Broadway theater, and they offered me a productions on the condition that I use another director.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I decided that was not good for me, for the play. It didn't come just out of loyalty. I found that my work has grown and deepened, and I always learn something by working with Norman, and I see no reason to not do that.
Let me ask you about one of your early collaborations. This was, I think, back in 1980, and I'm thinking of Marry Me a Little, and it's a review of Stephen Sondheim's songs that were cut from shows that he'd written, and Craig, you had written a story around the songs, you know, as kind of connective tissue for them, a framing story. Craig, can you tell me how the review came to be, how you got Sondheim's permission? I think you were singing in the chorus of Sweeney Todd at the time you asked him to do this.
Sweeney Todd had just closed on Broadway, and I was still a performer then. I was in the chorus of that show. Steve had read my first play, or the first act of that first play that Norman agreed to produce if I would finish it. While I was redoing that work, Norman had a friend who wanted to do a late-night cabaret at the production company, which used to do that on the same set of the plays that they did at 8 o'clock. At 11 o'clock or 10:30 or something, they would do some kind of a review, putting together, stringing songs together. And Norman asked me if I would write something. I said, no, I couldn't write two things at the same time, but I would certainly... I was game to, I would write Sondheim and ask him if there was any chance we could get our hands on some of his trunk songs that had been cut from his shows or had been written for other special material that had never been published. To my complete amazement, he said, sure, I think it's a terrible idea, but go ahead and do it. And he pretty much opened up his coffers, and we went through the songs together and pulled out about maybe 30, 35 of them, went through them, culled them down to, I think, 17. And then Norman and I together came up with the idea of framing them in two separate apartments, people alone on a Saturday night. But by joining the two apartments, merging them into one, you would see the people in the same space, though they were literally living over top of one another.
Craig, you're one of the two singers in the original production and in the cast recording.
You would bring that up.
Yeah, I've brought the record too.
No!
I like your singing a lot, and I want to play something from it. What would you rather hear, Happily Ever After or Who Could Be Blue?
Oh, Who Could Be Blue. I love that song.
Okay.
Who could be blue, knowing there's you somewhere nearby?
Given up singing? I mean, do you act or sing in anything anymore?
I perform nightly in my shower And that's the full extent of it. I sang at a friend's memorial this last year, and other than that, no, I don't sing anymore. I'd love to be invited. You know, I occasionally fantasize, gee, if someone would ask me, I would... what'd you say?
Beg you.
Beg me. I would sing, you know, at a one-shot sort of deal. I wouldn't want to have to do 8 shows a week. That's too hard.
Don't you miss it, though?
No.
You don't?
No.
Why not?
I was never very happy as a performer, to be perfectly honest. The only aspect of performing that I enjoyed was the singing. I am not comfortable in front of people. A great deal of the performer's psyche, I think, has to do with coming alive in front of people, and I'm actually much more comfortable hiding, watching, listening. I think that's why I'm a better writer than I am a performer. It's very, very painful for me, honestly.
The Tony Awards are coming up on Sunday. You're up for 2 for Prelude to a Kiss. Are you already, like, writing speeches in case you get the awards?
I actually got a letter at the theater yesterday from the producer of the Tony Awards encouraging me to not thank lots of people, to be, quote-unquote, entertaining. So I'm thinking of mooning him at the Tonys. And past that, no, I'm trying to not hope for much.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer Craig Lucas and director Norman Renee, they collaborated on the play Prelude to a Kiss and the new movie Longtime Companion. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll be hearing news of President Gorbachev arriving in Canada, and as Boris Yeltsin has been elected president of the Russian Republic, largest republic in the Soviet Union, we'll be talking with one of his political allies, Anatoly Sobchak, who's visiting this country. He is the mayor of Leningrad and also the chairman of the Economic Legislation Committee of the Supreme Soviet. Also, I talk with Kenneth Branagh, the director and star of the film Henry V, about laughing on stage and other problems that he's had, and a report on panic disorder and its possible treatment.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the fiction of Ian McEwan, characters can suddenly become victims. McEwan's novels include A Child in Time and The Cement Garden. His new novel is The Innocent. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Leonard Marnum, the semi-hero of Ian McEwan's new Cold War anti-thriller, is the most likable character in McEwan's peculiar fiction. McEwan's an English writer who'd really rather be a European. The corruptions of the continent are his psychic stuff. He can't get enough of Freud and incest and castration anxiety and cannibalism. In his first novel, The Cement Garden, orphaned children bury their dead mother in the cellar and turn into a primal horde. In his second novel, The Comfort of Strangers, a couple on a holiday in Venice go out late one night for something to eat and find razor blades, cemeteries, and sadomasochism. In between, there was a collection of stories, In Between the Sheets, in which one character eats ground glass and throws himself under a train. Another is ordered to wet his pants in a restaurant just before he is to meet the parents of the woman he thinks he loves. A third has sexual relations with an ape. And a fourth falls in love with a department store dummy, buys her, rapes and murders her, and then destroys his works of art, including a Vermeer. The Innocent is a little more mainstream. Leonard, who seems to have wandered in from somebody else's novel, probably a Graham Greene, is much nicer than any of McEwen's previous existential desperados. He's an expert in telephone circuitry, on loan to American intelligence in Berlin in 1955. American intelligence is digging a tunnel from the Allied to the Russian sector to tap the wires of the evil empire. Leonard, a virgin at espionage, is also innocent of sex and serious emotions like shame and desperation. He falls for Maria, one of those post-war German women who know the worst about everything. They go underground to diagram each other's circuits. The tunnel, of course, is symbolic. They are interrupted by Otto, Maria's abusive alcoholic ex-husband, a sort of reality principle. In self-defense, Leonard and Maria kill Otto. Otto, too, is symbolic. Like Germany, he must be dismembered, literally, with an axe and a saw. What we learn from this is that people can't be diagrammed, that communication is disinformation, that innocence is dangerous, that all secrets are guilty and Freudian, that language itself is coded emotion, and that rock and roll is bad for you. The virtues of the Innocent are many. Chilly suspensefulness, aphoristic bite, splendid evocations of Berlin as a wasteland, and the Cold War as a theology of secrets. But McEwen seems to have had in mind a larger design than the thriller. Like Kafka and Beckett, he's into speechlessness. Like Thomas Mann, he imagines an entire civilization gone to rot because of busy signals and wrong numbers. Sex here is the ultimate subversion of the authority of an exhausted culture, and sex is insufficient. I'm not sure that Leonard and Maria are big enough to carry such a burden and a blame. It's as if the novelist had stuck their heads in the pencil sharpener of his grand intention and ground them down until their points broke off. But it's creepy fun to watch them try. And there's a wonderful movie to be made from it. If only Orson Welles were still around, the third man in the shadows of the Ferris wheel.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Innocent by Ian McEwen. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, Dan Laughlin, and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of America's most controversial theater directors, Peter Sellers, fills us in on his plans for the Los Angeles Festival, a multicultural festival of the arts. Also, a talk with comic David Brenner. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.